From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Protests in Hong Kong continued this week with the organizing of a march that was massive in size and peaceful in nature. The Chinese government launched a disinformation campaign online about the movement, which was met with a forceful response from the social media companies hosting those accounts. In Afghanistan, peace talks are being held between the Taliban and the U.S. to end America's longest war, but a brutal wedding attack by ISIS underscored the tenuous nature of the efforts. In the face of a gauntlet of domestic and international challenges, U.S. President Donald Trump made a number of statements on subjects ranging from gun control in the United States to a proposed purchase of Greenland, and seemingly reversed his position on each of the subjects. And we'll take a look at the 2020 U.S. presidential race, including some interesting poll numbers and the narrowing of the field of Democratic Party candidates. Linda, Tom, welcome, as Hi. Always. Linda, I'm going to start with you, the latest on the Hong Kong protests.
Well, as the protests proceed, the list of issues grows. It started with a protest against allowing extradition from Hong Kong to China. And the leader of Hong Kong, who's backed by Beijing, she immediately caved on that, but has resisted withdrawing the legislation altogether. So that's point number one. They're also now demanding amnesty for all the arrested protesters. So we've been having protests for months. They want an independent inquiry into police brutality. They also want universal suffrage in elections for the Hong Kong chief executive. So they're holding on very mightily to the rights that Hong Kong has from its 1997 move toward away from British control.
Those are the issues kind of in reverse chronological order, because
right,
the
exactly.
very first thing was universal suffrage that was promised when we had the separation of Hong Kong from the UK and falling into Chinese rule. Tom, the protests have ranged from raucous to reverent almost in the last protest. I guess the question is, are the protests making a difference? Is China bending or responding or seeming to come around to the Hong Kong position in any way?
I don't really think so, Michael. I mean, maybe stylistically or in terms of public opinion, but there's no nice ways to say this, so I'm not going to be nice. China lied to the British and the rest of the world in the 1997 agreement. They said they'd do all sorts of things, and the only thing I think they've lived up to is the one country, two systems.
Yes.
China, Hong Kong still has its vibrant and robust capitalist system. But I think it's now clear, with the benefit of hindsight, of course, that the Chinese had no intentions of allowing fairly robust and vigorous democratic ideals to continue to flourish in Hong Kong. This is all about control. The Chinese are tough. They believe that they will do what they have to do. And so I think the Chinese are looking for ways to keep this from exploding, to keep from embarrassing them further on the global stage. I think they have no intention of doing what they said they would do specifically about democratic processes and democratic principles. I don't believe you'll ever have a elected chief executive of Hong Kong that has not been vetted by a Beijing-friendly bunch of outsiders.
And that's the way the process works now. It's every person who's in that governing committee in Hong Kong has been chosen by the
right.
Central Committee in China. Linda, I was in Hong Kong when Tiananmen Square happened.
Oh.
And I was living there, and it was sort of a defining moment in my life to watch that happen so close mm-hmm. to the actual mm-hmm. events. It's very difficult not to watch this and be afraid of a fork
yes.
in the road that takes us to something like that, a forceful and violent military response. I know that almost every democracy on the planet has urged restraint to the Chinese. Talk about the U.S. response to that. What's the U.S. response been? And what do you think are the prospects for something like Tiananmen Square happening again in central Hong Kong?
I would like to say that it won't happen again. I think China knows what happened after Tiananmen Square. They know the world is watching. China wants to be an economic force in the world.
Mm-hmm. But I also know that the Chinese know that they think that it worked. Tiananmen Square worked
well,
for them.
It
worked out for
in
them.
The short term, right? So it put down the protests. It put a lid on everything. But it's like a pressure cooker. The steam builds up and eventually it blows. And the Chinese government is great at tipping the lid a little bit and allowing some steam to come out and allowing allowing the most agitated Chinese citizens to feel that they're heard. But frankly, the Chinese citizens I know just don't even pay attention. They just think it's pointless to try to protest to Beijing. And so they're just disengaged. But if you're in Hong Kong and you see what's happening, you see what Beijing is doing and what they want to do. They've got forces lined up on the border in Shenzhen. They're playing with fire here. And if there's another Tiananmen, heaven help us. Even Donald Trump is concerned about that. He knows that that's bad for everything. It would really complicate things on the trade deal. I mean, China is all about global domination. They've got Belt and Road going all over the world, including Greenland.
Yeah.
And they want to keep going with that. They know that military force is not the path to global economic domination.
Right. Tom, there's a little bit of economic and political chess that's going on here, four-dimensional chess with the United States. When you talk about, of course, the trade war that's going on directly with China, then you have these arms sales to Taiwan that are going on at the same time, and you have the protests in Hong Kong there. When you look at those three legs of the stool, what I see is a balance here, or a conflict between capitalism and democracy for the U.S. With the administration and where they seem to be coming from, do you think that they are tilting that balance one way or the other, where they favor capitalism and the markets, especially with an election year coming up, versus democracy?
I think that's correct, although the State Department has put out a statement that's, on paper at least, sounds like they've got it right. They don't want violence. They want democratic principles to prevail and be sustained, and they hope everything is peaceful. And President Trump has been saying the same thing. I think Trump does not want to wade into it for a variety of global reasons and political reasons. So he's not going to be, he'll never come out and support verbally the protesters. He wouldn't say things like, well, we stand behind freedom-loving people everywhere in the world. He will also appeal for dialogue and reason on both sides, and that's probably about the best you can hope for the moment.
Again, I think that's about the best you can hope for the moment. I think sort of stitches that up pretty well as a subject. Let's move on to Afghanistan. The peace talks with the Taliban taking place in Kabul to end the longest U.S. military conflict. I'm going to stay with you, Tom, and we'll talk about the parties who are at the table. It is the U.S. and Taliban, but it seems like a couple of parties are missing from those talks if you really intend to have peace there.
Well, that's right. The president wants out of Afghanistan. This is one of the worst-kept secrets in his administration. He thinks it is the trillions of dollars.
He said it was ridiculous. He wants out. The U.S. is still there.
He wants out, and he does not worry. He does not seem to worry that if that were to happen, the Russians would come right back in. They've already built a brand new diplomatic complex in Kabul. The Chinese come back in, and I think it's fair to suggest that ISIS might come in as well. The president on this one, I think, seems to be bucking his entire military diplomatic establishment. They're very leery of just pulling out. So I think at some point there will be a split the difference sort of thing, where a few thousand American servicemen and servicewomen will come out, but we will have a presence there for a while, because I think the worst thing that could happen politically is for ISIS and the Taliban to reemerge, and for there to be more terrorism, and this awful incident at the wedding where 63 citizens were killed. That sent chills up and down the spine of American diplomats and State Department senior officials. So this is very tricky.
Absolutely. Your thoughts, Linda?
Yeah, I mean, this is the world's deadliest conflict in 2018. Yeah. More civilians died in Afghanistan last year than in the past decade. And in the past 10 years, 32,000 civilians have died in Afghanistan. It's horrific.
We've grown numb to the numbers.
As we have in many circumstances. Yes. But this is, Barack Obama wanted to get out of Afghanistan, but he was so domestically focused, it just never became a priority. And he allowed the generals to talk him into keeping things essentially as is. But it's just one of those no-win situations. And I agree with Tom that it will be a split-the-difference solution of leaving people there. I mean, we can't have nobody there. You've got, right now, you've got 20,000 foreign troops, most of them Americans, Americans are continuing to die.
Right.
So this is a NATO-led mission to train and help Afghan forces, but they're not even at the table. I mean, Zalmay Khalilzad, the envoy, he's going to have the meeting with the Taliban, then he's going to go see the Afghan government, and that's where we are.
And that's exactly where I was leading to my next question. I'll let you have the closing thought on this subject. You have ISIS not at the table. You have the Afghan government not at the table. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, when you have these talks, and assuming that they come out of this with something, the mm-hmm. Afghan government mm-hmm. is looking to make some sort of arrangement before, I think, elections that are in about a month. If you have an agreement, is this the beginning of peace, or is just like a new configuration for fighting?
It's a new configuration for fighting, and for the Americans, just it's reached the point where Donald Trump wants just to get out as much as he possibly can. He really is. He sees it as no win for him personally. He sees everything through the personal lens. And if he can just wipe the slate clean of that and not have to think about it, then it's...
That would be his preference,
sure.
Yeah, real quick, Tom.
One quick note. President Trump's dilemma is magnified by an article in the Washington Post recently by Congresswoman Liz Cheney of Wyoming, Dick Cheney's daughter, a very prominent Republican who said, and a former State Department official, she basically said, Mr. President, you can't get out. Don't make this mistake. The Russians will take over the country. It would be a disaster. And that puts more pressure on the president. And that's why I agree with Linda that I think there's going to be some middle ground that probably is the best that can be done, but the president won't like it either.
Let's take a break right there. We'll be back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. Panelists, I'm going to ask you to put on your intellectual tracksuits for this one. Even in this administration, which is specializes in sort of amazingly quotable weeks, there were some amazing quotes and requotes and what have you this week. So let's just get to it. And I want to try to break this down in four general categories. President Trump's comments about Jews who are Democrats in the United States, the proposed purchase of Greenland, the economy, and the position of background checks, the status of how that would be in gun control in the United States. Let's start off with the comments on Jewish Democrats. President Trump started off by saying in the Oval Office, I think any Jewish people that vote for a Democrat, I think it shows either a total lack of knowledge or great disloyalty. In clarification on the White House lawn the next day, he said, if you vote for a Democrat, you're very, very disloyal to Israel and to the Jewish people. Again, I guess I'll start. What prompted that? What was the impetus for that statement? If we can pin it down to any one particular thing.
This is part of the long-running dispute he's been having with these members of Congress, the Squad. These are four minority women freshmen in Congress who are very outspoken, very liberal, very anti-Trump. He's trying to make them the face of the Democratic Party, and he says that openly. There was this issue last week of two of them who were supposed to visit Israel. Israel was willing to have them come, and then Donald Trump tweeted that they shouldn't be allowed to come because of their support of an anti-Israel boycott.
Right.
And so Trump tweeted that they shouldn't be allowed in. Next thing we know, Israel has blocked them. So this is a continuation of that whole theme that the Democratic Party is anti-Semitic, and that anybody who supports the Democrats is therefore anti-Israel and therefore anti-Semitic. But even this talk of loyalty is itself an anti-Semitic trope, that anybody who doesn't support Israel or the Israeli policy in its current configuration is anti-Semitic. More than two-thirds of American Jews are Democrats, And if Donald Trump thinks he's going to win Jewish Democratic hearts and minds by threatening them in that way, he is sadly mistaken.
It would seem to be a daunting prospect at best. A number of people were very upset about this because of the talk of disloyalty, because it seemed at some point as though the comment was directed at both Jewish Democrats and the American congresspeople, saying that they are being disloyal to the United States by taking a position that is different than the current Israeli government position and the Trump White House itself. Your response to that?
It's breathtaking. It's all, you know, President Trump is often breathtaking. This is, he's outdone himself on this one.
Right, and I love having you here for these sort of moments because, as I say, you're always the historian of issues in the news. I mean, have you ever seen?
No, I've never seen a week like this where there was so much swirling in the air, kind of the president stepping on both feet and his message generally. Let's don't forget that his daughter, Ivanka, has converted to Judaism, and her husband, one of the president's top senior aides, Jared Kushner, is Jewish. I spent the last several days talking to Jewish Americans who work for and raise money for President Trump. And of course, they can't go public, but they are appalled. They're beside themselves. And one of them said to me, of all the problems that we have at the moment politically, this one we shouldn't have to be worrying about. And it's just the unpredictability is, and the audacity is breathtaking.
Yeah, I looked at this comment, and it evoked memories of a comment that then-candidate Hillary Clinton made during the previous election cycle when in a campaign fundraiser she mentioned or called a group of people deplorables, mm-hmm. talking about a certain group of people and referring to their education and their religious beliefs or leanings or that sort of thing. But she called them the deplorables. And I think that was a defining and galvanizing moment for the opposition. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were numerous T-shirts and hats that were printed of the deplorables before there were MAGA hats. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if this thing, this disloyalty thing, could be Donald Trump's deplorables moment. Do you think that this could galvanize a type of opposition in the same way that deplorables did for Hillary?
I don't know about that. I think this week, as Tom said, this has been maybe the craziest week yet of the Trump presidency, which is saying a lot in terms of his rhetoric, him flip-flopping all over the place, one day saying one thing, and sometimes within moments saying the complete opposite. It's a form of gaslighting. You're trying to understand where he's coming from, and he'll say something. He wants to cut payroll taxes, and then the next, you know, moments later, he's saying, no, he's not going to cut payroll taxes. He's at the base of all of this is a fear that we're going into recession. And he's concerned that his opposition is trying to talk the public into thinking that we're about to go into recession. There are warning signs and, yes, and black clouds on the horizon, maybe not until 2021, but a lot of voting is all about perception and not necessarily facts. So if people think that Trump is leading us into recession, they could vote on that basis.
Right.
So this is really what's at the heart of all of what's been going on, whether it's him talking about buying Greenland and then canceling a trip to Denmark because Denmark won't sell us Greenland. It's almost too much to process.
And so I think you hit on a very important point, that there's a lot of the Trump presidency that understands, they have an understanding that perception,
yes,
is powerful. And it's not necessarily based on facts, let's say, but perception is so much of it. So Tom, I'm going to ask you, when we talk about, and we can combine all these subjects, when you talk about the economy and, you know, blaming everyone from the Fed chair to the Germans to whoever,
the
media's fault of the presenting a perception, when you have pulling out of a state visit to Denmark, all of these things, is this just all sort of a misdirection about the economy, do you think? And who are the adults in the room that are going to pull this administration towards a more typical, let's say, form of politics?
I think most of the adults in the room, Michael, have left. Secretary of Defense James Mattis is gone. The economic advisors who seem to have a better sense of what's going on in the global economy have gone a year ago. And I think there are days I think that the president's chief domestic advisors are his friends from Fox News, Sean Hannity and Lou Dobbs. But I think all of this suggests the president is nervous because he does understand that in this country, perception is usually more important than reality. And I have seen this election after election. And one of the most durable indicators of public mood is right track, wrong track. Mm. And if the country decides, for whatever reason, fear or not, that the country is on the wrong track, that's a powerful negative for whoever is in power. That hurt George H.W. Bush when he wanted to be reelected. And I saw a recent poll that showed almost 60% of the American people think the country is on the wrong track. And I think the president's trying desperately to figure out a way to fix that perception, because he knows it could be a lethal perception.
I know you wanted to say something. I'm going to ask you to comment on background checks, because when we talk about Greenland, okay, that in other administrations, that would be an almost humorous topic to talk about a purchase of Greenland. Background checks on guns is not. That's a very serious issue. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about perception, I think Trump likes to be on the right side of a stampede. Every poll that I've seen suggests that somewhere around 90% of Americans approve of background checks. How can he politically survive saying at one point, I'm definitely going to get background checks done, this for maybe the third time while he's been in office, and then over the course of a week completely back off of that?
So we already have background checks in most cases. It's really a matter of closing some loopholes. So I think part of the problem may be the public not fully understanding what we already have in place and then what could be tweaked. I think if you walk people through the problem, there's something called the gun show loophole, that if you're purchasing a firearm at a gun show, there's no background check. So that could be fixed. After the back-to-back shootings a couple of weekends ago, the president, true to form, said he wanted to do something. I mean, he always wants to do something, right? He likes to sign things. He likes to be seen as a man of action, as a man who's solving problems. Then the National Rifle Association chimes in, and they're undergoing tremendous turmoil right now. They're having financial problems, but they're still powerful. And it isn't even about the NRA. It's about gun owners who are, some of them, single-issue voters, and many of them are Trump supporters. So even if the NRA were to go away, their power would not disappear completely. And what we saw this week was Donald Trump kind of being whipsawed between his impulse to do something and to be seen making an accomplishment that perhaps could prevent a few shootings, but then having Wayne LaPierre, the top person at the NRA, come in and talk to him and talk him back. But then he went back again in that press chopper talk on the South Lawn on Wednesday, which I suffered through personally. He sounded like he was ready to go again with maybe some new legislation on background checks. So we'll see. What I'm told is that he's waiting for Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, to lay down his marker on that. They're still on recess, but when they come back in September, we'll see what the pro-gun control crowd can do. And they're also building in power and in money resources. So that's, I think, a new key element to this whole picture.
I think I agree with you. We'll see what happens when Congress comes back. We just have a couple of minutes left. I want to really quickly go over a couple of numbers. I had a number of polls here ranging from Monmouth University polls, CNN, NBC. All of them show the president holding less than 50% approval rating, somewhere around the 40s, 40, 40%, some as low as 38. No president has been elected with less than 50% approval rating. So it seems as though that's one bellwether for the president there. And then you have several Democrats dropping out of the race this week. And Linda?
Yeah, I think the thing to know about President Trump's job approval is that he's about where Barack Obama and George W. Bush were at this point in their presidencies. And you really can't look at that situation now and project that forward, because the presidential election is not a referendum. It's a choice. So I think who the Democrats nominate is absolutely critical. The people in the middle that somebody who voted for Trump in 2016, who's unhappy with him and who might vote Democrat next time, if the Democrats go too far left, that could hand it back to Trump. Trump could be reelected very easily.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's those prized, sort of unusual and fascinating people who voted twice for Obama and then voted for Trump.
There's a lot of them.
And I'd like to go out and meet a couple of them personally. It'd be fascinating.
A little bit of a hidden Trump vote, too, last time and maybe this time, of people who are going to vote for Trump but never tell pollsters they're going to. We'll have to see.
That's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. This program is produced by VOA's Carol Castiel. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.